It's Tuesday, October 31st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Doug Bernardi in Washington. Coming up, a lone wolf terror attack in New York City leaves at least 8 dead. A humanitarian crisis is reported to be worsening in Syria, and singer Camila Cabello hits it big. It's all coming up ahead on International Edition. At least 8 people were killed Tuesday and more than a dozen others were injured when a man drove a rented truck onto a busy bike path in New York City. At about 3:05 p.m., a man driving a rented Home Depot pickup truck entered the bike path, striking riders and pedestrians. The truck also struck a school bus, injuring 2 adults and 2 children. The man, identified as Saifullo Saipov from Tampa, Florida, then exited the vehicle brandishing 2 weapons. A paintball gun and a pellet gun were later found at the scene. He was shot in the abdomen by police and taken into custody. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio called it a cowardly act of terror.
It's a very painful day in our city. Horrible tragedy on the West Side. Let me be clear that based on the information we have at this moment, this was an act of terror and a particularly cowardly act of terror. Aimed at innocent civilians, aimed at people going about their lives who had no idea what was about to hit them. We, at this moment, based on the information we have, we know of 8 innocent people who have lost their lives and over a dozen more injured. We know that this action was intended to break our spirit. But we also know New Yorkers are strong, New Yorkers are resilient, and our spirit will never be moved by an act of violence, an act meant to intimidate us.
VOA New York reporter Tina Trin was among the first on the scene and joins us. Tina, this happened at about 3 p.m. in the afternoon. It must have been awfully crowded at that time.
Yeah, you have a lot of people, whether they're tourists or locals, utilizing that bike lane. It's also not that far from a trail that runs along the Hudson River, so you have views of New Jersey across the river, and it's pretty picturesque. You also have, vendors who are up and down along Hudson River, so it's a popular pathway, but it's also happens to be near a major roadway. I believe it's a 4-lane, roadway, two-way traffic. And so there's a lot of activity. There's also schools nearby. Stuyvesant is nearby, and you have kids getting ready to come out of school right around that time. You also have the borough of Manhattan Community College nearby on the other side of the road. So there's a lot of activity. There's residential towers that are near there as well. Businesses, shopping, retail stores. So it's a very kind of, obviously, a lot of activity happening in that section of Manhattan.
When you arrived, can you tell us a little bit about the scene, what you saw when you arrived?
Right. So when we arrived, the police had already barricaded a lot of the major intersections in and around the scene of the accident. So we were not able to get past certain sections of the neighborhood. You had a lot of police on the scene, a lot of witnesses still hanging out on the street, a lot of traffic cops trying to redirect, cars and pedestrians, a lot of people just milling around trying to figure out what happened. It was pretty chaotic.
Last question. When we've seen auto attacks like this in Paris, Marseille, England, we've seen that the larger community sort of is tamped down and shut down by police barricades and that sort of thing. What's the feeling like in New York City tonight?
Right now, from the people that we spoke to and the residents who lived in the who live in the neighborhoods near surrounding neighborhoods, there's still a larger sense, I think, of let's just kind of get on with our lives. Like if we don't go out, you know, they win. And so for a lot of folks, if you were to go out right now, you would still see them out with their kids trick-or-treating in costume. And they're trying to keep the night as enjoyable as possible for the sake of their children.
Tina Trinn, thank you so much for the thoughts.
You're welcome.
Andrew Palcheski joins now, as he often does. Andrew, I imagine the news of this terror attack in New York City is still filtering through and down social media, but I understand thousands of people are also talking about the heads of social media giant companies testifying before Congress today. Is that right?
A big day on Capitol Hill here in Washington, just blocks away from our Voice of America headquarters, where you had representatives from Facebook, Twitter, and Google testifying to the Senate Intelligence Committee about Russian interference on those platforms. Now, this has been an issue that we've been talking about for months, revolving around Russian interference around and during the 2016 U.S. presidential election. But October 31st was the first of 2 days where those companies are finally speaking to lawmakers. So you had the general counsel from Facebook, the acting general counsel from Twitter, and the director of Google's Law Enforcement and Information Security Department getting grilled by senators about what they knew, how extensive this interference was, and what steps they're taking to try to prevent it going forward.
Now, I know that very often you're tracking what people are saying out there, but you're also tracking, and you follow very closely, what's happening with the industry. So what was it that lawmakers were wanting to learn, and what was it that the witnesses were saying?
Well, I think the lawmakers wanted to get a solid answer on how wide this interference was on social media. And even before those lawyers testified on Capitol Hill, we got reports from Twitter and Facebook that the Russian interference was actually more extensive than they originally reported. Facebook saying that up to 126 million people may have seen some of these ads that were purchased by Russian agents. Twitter saying that more than 130,000 tweets were linked directly to Russia's Internet Research Agency, which is the arm of the Kremlin that deals with online misinformation. So I think that's the first part of information, the first piece of information lawmakers wanted to get was how wide does this go? Give us a solid scope answer of what the extent of this interference was.
I think we know that Russian agents, whether directly operating under the auspices of the Russian government or employees and trolls or whoever, and we've covered this long before, so this is not controversial, have been putting out all these stories that just sort of create a churn in information. But what were the tech people saying about what effect it might have? I mean, so what if a bunch of people are putting out a bunch of fake stuff?
And that was precisely the defense from those tech company executives. They said, for instance, Colin Stretch, who is the general counsel for Facebook, said that one out of approximately every 23,000 pieces of content on Facebook was linked to these Russian interference and these Russian efforts. So he said it's 0.004% of all content, a minuscule number.
Oh, I hate math.
They, you know, this is the line of reasoning, though. They're saying that, yes, there was interference, but it was so minuscule, or there's such a kind of fire hose of content that people are being bombarded with every day that it likely had very little impact.
But it's more sophisticated than that, because it's not just everybody that's getting the same fire hose of information. It's various people that are being targeted with various pieces of content. So I would have to say, I don't know, if I were sitting up on the committee, I would find some exception with that.
Doug, I think you could be a U.S. senator, because that is pretty much where that is pretty much where the rebuttal came from the Senate Intelligence Committee, that where were these ads going to and who was being targeted, how much was being spent. It really, the devil's in the details. And that actually plays into a piece of legislation that's been introduced in the past few weeks. It's called the Honest Ads Act. And what this would require would be social media companies to disclose how much is being spent on these ads, who is buying them, who is being targeted, really giving users a picture of the demographics behind these ads. Now, in one interesting moment, Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, who's one of the co-sponsors of this Honest Ads Act, asked the social media companies point blank if they would comply with this. And they kind of gave her a runaround. They didn't say outright that they would comply with this. They said they would work internally. Now, that's a big hang-up for a lot of lawmakers, that these companies say, well, we're going to police this internally. We're going to up our security. There have been reports that they want to hire more people with security clearances and investigative backgrounds. Not good enough for the senators. They say there needs to be government oversight. There needs to be some external entity that's looking into these companies and what's going on there.
Don't believe everything you see online.
That's absolutely the point that they're trying to drive home in these hearings, that this information that you may have seen thinking it was totally legit or an advocacy group maybe buying these ads could have been coming from thousands of miles away, right in the heart of Moscow.
Andrew Palcheski, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Andrew Palcheski is VOA's social media editor. Here are some of the top headlines we're following at this hour. A high-level North Korean defector is urging engagement with Pyongyang. Gunfire and protests are reported in Eritrea's capital. Six are dead after an ambush on the Malian High Court president. And the Iraqi parliament criminalizes display of Zionist symbols across the country. Much more coverage of these stories and many others at our website, voanews.com. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Pennsylvania State University astronomers studying Hubble Space Telescope observations found that it snows titanium oxide on half of the hot exoplanet Kepler-13ab. Titanium oxide is one of the key ingredients in sunscreen. Kepler-13ab is part of a multiple star system with at least three solar components and is located some 1,730 light-years from Earth. The exoplanet is tidally locked to its primary star, Kepler-13a, which means it has a permanent day and night side, like the Moon is with Earth. The titanium oxide snow was found to be falling on the night side of the planet. The astronomers say Kepler-13ab orbits its primary star so closely that the day side of the exoplanet is about 2760 degrees Celsius. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition on The Voice of America, coming to you live from Washington, D.C. I'm Doug Bernard. Coming up, Camila Cabello is cooking up some hot new Cubano sounds. First, the UN Security Council was warned on Monday that a serious humanitarian crisis is intensifying in Syria, even as Islamic State militants are being driven out of their stronghold Raqqa. The UN Emergency Relief Coordinator, Mark Lowcock, said more than 400,000 civilians have been displaced by a year of fighting in and around Raqqa, while death, injury, and displacement have impacted hundreds of thousands more in recent months in eastern Deir ez-Zor.
6.3 million of them are exceptionally vulnerable and in acute need as a result of displacement, hostilities, and limited access to basic goods and services. Military operations and hostilities in some parts of the country, particularly in the east, continue to drive displacement. The number of long-term internally displaced people, IDPs, has decreased from 6.3 to 6.1 million over the last year. But levels of new displacement remain high, with some 1.8 million reported to have been displaced between January and September. Humanitarian access to Eastern Ghouta, one of the four de-escalated areas where nearly 95% of Syria's besieged population lives, has been severely curtailed for months. Today, the UN and partners delivered food, nutrition, and health assistance to 40,000 people. an alarming number of child malnutrition cases have been recorded there, and more than 400 people with health problems require medical evacuation.
David Lesh, Trinity University history professor, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty that the Syrian regime has used access to humanitarian assistance as a weapon to force concessions from rebels and their supporters and submission to its control.
The crisis point of this conflict in terms of being a situation that could ravel out of control into the entire Middle East has subsided somewhat with what appears to be, you know, the regime stabilizing itself with the support of Iran and Russia in particular, and the Syrian opposition having been reduced to just a shadow of what it used to be.
If food is being used as a weapon by the Syrian regime, does that amount to a war crime that ought to be prosecuted?
I think on the surface, it certainly seems to be. The details of these types of things have to be discussed at appropriate levels in the International Crimes Division and in the UN and so forth. But this has been a charge against the regime throughout the conflict. They will put forth strategic reasons or a rationale that it's unsafe and so forth. And there's just enough activity to lend some credence to that notion. So it's very hard to prove.
The seventh round of the so-called Astana talks involving Russia, Turkey, and Iran in the Kazakh capital resumed on de-escalating the six-year-long conflict. What hope do you have for any progress?
Well, it's made some significant progress in terms of establishing de-escalation zones, particularly cooperation between Russia, Iran, and most importantly, Turkey on that front, because Turkey has a great deal of influence with a number of the Syrian opposition groups. So there has been some progress, and therefore there are notable pockets where the conflict has been reduced significantly, and that has allowed for humanitarian access and allowed for some return to normalcy. But it's important to remember that the Astana process really is dealing with security issues. It is not necessarily dealing with a political settlement. I think the Russians have admitted that they would like the United States and the international community involved, and they still maintain connections with the UN Special Envoy and the Geneva process to try to generate some sort of political settlement which will allow for the long-term resolution of the Syrian conflict.
David Lesh of Trinity University, he was speaking there with VOA's Victor Beatty. On the other side of the globe, Australia has closed its controversial offshore detention center in Papua New Guinea, but more than 600 refugees and asylum seekers are refusing to leave. The men say they fear for their safety in the local community and are uncertain about their future. Australian officials have left the facility and water and power supplies are being switched off. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
About 600 men remain inside the Papua New Guinea detention centre. Most of them are refugees, including many from Myanmar, Iran and Afghanistan. They insist they're too scared to leave the processing centre and are refusing to move to new accommodation elsewhere on the island. They say they've stockpiled food and water, and it's unclear when or if they'll be forced out by Papua New Guinea authorities. Senator Nick McKim, an immigration spokesperson for the Australian Greens, says the detainees fear for their safety.
They don't believe it's safe here in the Manus community for them, and we've seen, you know, multiple machete attacks and knife attacks over recent months, and the guys are in the fear for their lives.
Advocates say about 480 of the 600 men inside the Manus Island facility are refugees. The rest are asylum seekers, many of whom have had their refugee claims rejected. The fate of all of them is unclear. Papua New Guinea says the men are Australia's responsibility, but Canberra won't resettle any of the Manus Island detainees under tough asylum and border protection policies. Kate Schutze, a researcher with the rights group Amnesty International, claims the Manus Island detainees are being abandoned by Australia.
Essentially, there's no real plan here for them to be able to rebuild their lives. So that's really quite alarming. All indications around these new centres and the security around these new centres seems to indicate that they're moving them from one prison to another with no logical rationale behind it.
Since 2013, Australia has incarcerated all asylum seekers who try to reach its shores by boat on Manus Island and Nauru, a tiny Pacific republic. Canberra has said the policy deters people trafficking and prevents deaths at sea. But the conditions inside the camps have been described by the United Nations and human rights groups as cruel. The United States has agreed to resettle some of the refugees from Manus Island and Nauru under a deal Australia reached with the Obama administration last year. In September, 22 men, including those from Sudan, Bangladesh and Rohingya Muslims from Myanmar, became the first to be moved from the offshore detention centre in Papua New Guinea to the United States. It's unclear how many refugees Washington will eventually resettle. In return, Australia will take in Central American refugees from the United States. Last year, a court in Papua New Guinea ruled the Australian-funded camp on Manus Island was unconstitutional. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And this is The Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition, coming to you live from Washington, D.C. I'm Doug Bernard. A young singer from Miami has a new single that's getting a lot of international attention. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London recently sat down with Sarah Williams to talk about the new sensation.
Today we're talking about Camila Cabello. And you may or may not know her name as a solo artist, but you certainly know the band that she came from, Fifth Harmony. She was with Fifth Harmony from the beginning when they were discovered on The X Factor in 2012. She was the first member of the group to leave to pursue a solo career. She did that this past January. And today we're going to be talking about her second single. The first one, Crying in the Club, did very well from her debut album, which is The Hurting, the Healing, the Loving. And she had to delay that album release. It was supposed to come out within the last few months, but she's pushed it to 2018. Apparently, she and her producing team are not real satisfied with the outcome of the album, so they're going to tweak a few things and release it a little later on. But the new single is doing so well, it's number one this week in the UK. So congratulations to Camila for that success. And it's her first top 10 hit in the United States. So with all that build up, let's check out Camila Cabello, and the song is called Havana.
Havana.
So what is Camila known for in the music business?
Well, she's 20. She's not known for a whole lot right now, other than being in Fifth Harmony. She is a rising star for sure. The music video for the song Havana, which we just heard, has already attracted over 100 million views. She performed on stage at the Latin American Music Award Show last week, and she's getting a lot of attention. She's very proud of her Cuban heritage. She's Cuban-American, having grown up in Miami. And the music video is a very Latin-flavored video where some guy and girl are in bed. They get caught by his girlfriend, and it becomes a dramatic event. And so she's in the video singing the new song, Havana. She said she has an alter ego, which is kind of interesting. I mean, Beyonce made the alter ego famous with Sasha Fierce. But according to Camila, her alter ego's name is Carla. She's normally reserved as Camila. She's a very quiet girl. She has been known to have anxiety and panic attacks. In fact, during a Fifth Harmony show last year, she ran off the stage in one of her anxiety attacks. So she likes to channel her outer-going, more vibrant, wild self through this person called Carla, who makes an appearance in this video as well, where she really lets loose. And she's been on tour with Bruno Mars for his 24 Karat Magic Tour. She is getting set to perform on the Billboard Latin Music Award show. And, of course, she's going to go out on her own solo tour as well to support the new album, which is The Hurting, The Healing, The Loving, and Havana is her second song off the album, already number one in the UK.
be interesting to have a meeting between Carla and Camila.
I always found it interesting how these people who are one thing can all of a sudden dig deep and find another part of their personality and call it something else. Because if it's in there, it's in there.
Right.
You know, but there you go. Camila Cabello, the first to leave Fifth Harmony. There's now new talk that maybe the group is breaking up, although the members say that's not the case. But Dina has just recorded a new solo single. And Lauren has a new solo single coming out with her boyfriend Ty Dolla $ign. And Normani, who was on Dancing with the Stars, she has signed a solo artist management contract. But she says, no, I'm not leaving the band. But she signed to be represented as a solo artist. So the future is unclear for Fifth Harmony. It is clear for Camila Cabello. She's on the fast track to fame and fortune.
All right. Thanks very much, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings.
And that's going to do it for us for this half hour. Thanks so much for joining us for International Edition. We hope you'll be with us again tomorrow, same time.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has supported Burma's gradual transition toward an open democratic society in recent years. But at the same time, we express our gravest concern with recent events in Rakhine State and the violent, dramatic abuses Rohingya and other communities have endured, said State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert. It is imperative, she said, that any individuals or entities responsible for atrocities, including non-state actors and vigilantes, be held accountable. That's why the United States is taking the following actions. Since August 25th, the United States has ceased consideration of JADE Act travel waivers for current and former senior leadership of the Burmese military. The U.S. is considering economic options available to target individuals associated with atrocities. All units and officers involved in operations in northern Rakhine State are considered to be ineligible to receive or participate in any U.S. assistance programs. The U.S. has rescinded invitations for senior Burmese security forces to attend U.S.-sponsored events. The U.S. is working with international partners to gain access to relevant areas for the United Nations fact-finding mission, international humanitarian organizations, and media. The U.S. is consulting with allies and partners on accountability options at the U.N., the U.N. Human Rights Council, and other appropriate venues. And the U.S. is also exploring targeted sanctions. The United States will continue to support Burma's transition to democracy, as well as efforts to resolve the current crisis in Rakhine State, which has caused more than 600,000 Rohingya to flee since August 25th. The government of Burma, including its armed forces, must take immediate action to ensure peace and security, implement commitments to ensure humanitarian access to communities in desperate need, facilitate the safe and voluntary return of those who have fled or been displaced in Rakhine State, and address the root causes of systematic discrimination against the Rohingya by implementing the Rakhine Advisory Commission's recommendations, which includes providing a credible path to citizenship. The United States stands ready to support these efforts.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.